I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. All right, we're back with another episode of The Stacks with me, Tracy Thomas, your host. Today, we've brought back author and podcaster Ben Blacker for The Stacks Book Club. We'll be discussing The World Only Spins Forward by Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce, which is an oral history of Tony Kushner's play, Angels in America. You can hear more about this book on The Short Stacks when we interviewed Isaac Butler a few weeks back. More on the book later, but first, just a reminder to get your book recommendations from The Stacks. We've got a new segment called Ask The Stacks. You send us an email with what you're looking for in a book, maybe a few books you've liked or disliked, and then we'll give you personalized book recommendations on the air. So email askingthestacks@gmail.com. If you like the show and want to support the work we're doing, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Patreon allows for people like me to make podcasts like this with the help of people like you. It's easy and you earn perks like our virtual book club and priority for Ask the Stacks and more. So to join the Stacks pack, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Also want to give a shout out to Brianna Avery for being a loyal member of the Stacks pack. If a monthly contribution doesn't work for you, consider one-time contributions at paypal.me/thestackspod. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts, especially if you're listening through Apple Podcasts. It goes a long way to help us reach new audiences and book exciting guests. Our most recent review comes from Third Coast Reads. They say, "The Stacks is by far my favorite podcast. I tune in every week to hear the latest episodes. The content is great and I enjoy listening to the social commentary between Tracy and the guests. My favorite episode is the one discussing Between the World and Me." Third Coast Reads, that episode is always brought up as people's favorite. Jay Connor was such an amazing guest. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, go back and check it out. Also, on our website, to celebrate our 1-year anniversary, I put together the Stacks Superlatives, which were a bunch of episodes that I thought were fun and awesome. So if you want to check that out for other great episodes, go to thestackspodcast.com. Okay, let's dive into our conversation with Ben Blacker about The World Only Spins Forward. And don't worry, no spoilers today, so you can listen and enjoy. All right, you guys, we're back with the Stacks Book Club. Today, our guest is again the wonderful Ben Blacker. We're talking about The World Only Spins Forward, which is the oral history of the play Angels in America by Tony Kushner. And the book was written by Dan Coyce and Isaac Butler. And Ben, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited you're here. I'm just going to say it right now. There aren't going to be really spoilers this week because it's kind of hard to spoil a thing that's about a thing that existed since 1991, allegedly.
That it's an oral history.
Yeah.
It's like, there's not even prose style to
talk
about.
Exactly. So there's nothing to spoil. We're talking about a piece of art from the early 80s or mid 80s.
About a piece of art about a piece of
art. About a piece of art. Exactly. Correct. So listen if you want. Enjoy it.
If you leave now, at least follow us on Twitter.
At the SaxPod _. So here's the deal. I don't really know how to talk about this book.
Yeah.
Which I think is fair to say, because it's an oral history about a thing. It's a thing about a thing, and it covers so much. Mm-hmm.
And yet I found it didn't cover enough, which we can get into.
Which I definitely want to get into. So let's just start with, what did you think of the book?
As I mentioned on our previous episode, I was pretty unfamiliar with Angels in America.
Right.
I'm not a big theater person. I actually avoided the theater until seeing Hamilton, because my wife saw it and went crazy. And then my friend was like, just fucking go. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of people doing the best work, like a bunch of people at the top of their games in every aspect doing this thing. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll go. Oh, this is what theater is.
Right.
And it feels like Angels in America had that same effect 20 years before.
Yeah.
So I didn't really know it. I thought it was a musical.
Okay.
I didn't understand the scope of it.
Yeah.
I knew it was about AIDS and I knew it was about bureaucracy. I didn't know it was about bureaucracy of angels.
Right.
So for me, there was a lot of catching up to do in reading the book. I've read a handful of oral histories.
Okay.
And I think they're kind of hit or miss. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm curious to hear your interview with the author.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how these books are put together to form a cohesive story.
Right.
And I think this is not a great oral history.
Okay.
But I think there's so much good stuff in it that it's worth reading anyway.
All right. I want to know what about this book you think is not great as far as an oral history. And I'm asking that because I don't know a ton about oral histories. Mm-hmm. The two oral histories that I've read are both long form articles. They were on Grantland. Do you remember that website? It was like a sports website, Simmons. Now it's called The Ringer and it's not, anyways. But they did one on the 1989 earthquake during the World Series and it was great.
That's cool.
And then they did one on the Malice at the Palace, the fight in basketball between the Pacers and the Pistons. Mm-hmm. Also great, but short. Yeah. Like they didn't have to cover a ton. I mean, they could have covered way more. Which to your point, I think is maybe true a lot in oral histories is like there's kind of more because people bring up things and then it's like, oh, could you go off on a tangent about the building of the Golden Gate Bridge or like, you know? So I feel like I don't necessarily know what makes an oral history great.
I don't know that I do either. Okay. I know the best one I've read was that oral history of Saturday Night Live that came out.
Is that like These Guys Have All the Fun or something? Oh no, that was the ESPN one.
Yeah, that's right. No, this was, I can't remember what it's called.
Right,
I think
we'll
it's called
it
Live from
notes.
New York.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, that sounds right.
But they basically had everybody who was ever involved with the show in kind of every aspect, too, like a lot of the technical stuff. And you had 30 years, almost 40 years of show to talk about. So you knew they were going to hit certain things, but you also got these sort of recurring themes that I think the authors were really good about setting up and paying off.
Okay.
And in this Angels in America book, which I can never remember the title of.
The World Only Spins Forward.
Sure, that rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. It's a line from the play.
I assume.
Yeah.
In this book, I don't feel like there was a narrative arc to it.
Okay.
I feel like there's great behind the scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. What I didn't get, which is the thing I really wanted, was more Tony Kushner.
Yeah.
I wanted to know about the writing of this play, and the stuff about how he actually wrote the play is like 5 pages.
Right.
Towards the beginning. I thought there was one great bit where it talks about how long it was.
Right.
And he was like, they gave him, like, his contract said it can only be this long.
Right.
And then the first act was twice that or something.
Right. And he was like, oops, I'm going to make it 2 plays.
Yeah.
Like,
I love that.
Tony Kushner's great. He's notorious. So I have a theater background. I went to theater school. I love the theater. A lot of the people in this book have been people that I've looked to, like legends of the theater, like Oscar Eustace when I was in college was running the Public at New York. So he's actually, I think, who brought Hamilton
That's
to
cool.
the Public.
Yeah.
And George C. Wolfe, he's a really well-known theater director. He directed the Broadway production. So seeing a lot of those names like in the book, and like Tony Kushner, who's famous for going off on tangents and like famous for always way more. You ask him like, how was your day? And it's like a full spin out.
But I didn't get that in the book.
Really?
Like, that's what I wanted. I wanted him to really dig into his own creative process, where he really felt like an outsider in this.
Yeah.
Like, so much of it was about the various productions of the play, which more than anything, this book made me want to see every version
every
of this play.
Yeah. The truth is, so I've never actually seen a live performance of Angels. I've seen the movie, only the first one. I've never seen Perestroika performed.
Oh, really?
And I realized I'd never read Perestroika.
Oh, wow.
So I knew the first play. In college, like, everyone does scenes from it. The Eyeburn dinner scene is like super famous with Harper and Joe, and like everyone does that. And then the scene they talked a lot about in the book, the Lewis and Belize scene, like the racist scene, everyone does that. Every almost kind of Jewish looking guy at NYU wants to perform that scene. It's like, Hymetown. Anyways, so I knew a lot of the scenes, but I'd never read the full play. So after I finished the book, I went and I read the full play.
But you knew.
I knew the story. I knew how it started. I knew the middle. I knew it. It was not new information to me, but actually reading all the words in the play was new for me, which was, I maybe did it backwards. Like, maybe you should read the play first.
Did you
ever read the play?
I never read
the play. You
didn't
read it. Okay.
It really made me want to read it because it seems like an incredible document.
It's incredible.
I did, concurrent to reading the book, I watched the HBO series.
Okay.
Which was really helpful.
Yeah.
But even, like, I think the scenes that they sort of dig in on and tell stories about in the oral history, they do a good job setting up what that is. Like, I read about that Belize scene before getting to it in the movie. And I sort of knew what they were talking about. Like, it was plenty. I think the miniseries is fine.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of great actors. Justin Kirk is awesome.
Justin Kirk is so great.
Yeah. I think
they're all so good, actually.
They're all really good.
Who played Ben Shankman? No, who plays Lewis?
I don't know his name.
I can't remember. I think it's Ben Shankman.
That sounds
maybe,
right.
Maybe something like that.
Yeah.
He's great. Meryl Streep, Al Pacino, like, bye, of course.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
When I turned it on and Meryl Streep was this rabbi.
Rabbi. It's a little weird. So the thing that the movie loses that the play has is the magic. You can be a man on stage as a woman being a ridiculous caricature, and that totally works on stage.
Yeah.
Like, having an angel fly in from the ceiling or whatever, that's like actually really cool on stage. In the movie, it's like, like, they still do a great job,
it's
like, this is
magic.
A movie.
We've seen this stuff.
Exactly. So like, the play is such, like, when I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, I would die to see this scene. Like, they're naked people on stage. Like, that's really visceral in the theater. Yeah. Like, to see a naked body in the theater is not that common.
Sure.
Like, maybe you get butt cheeks, but like full
if
frontal.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky, like someone's changing, you know, like Take Me Out is that musical with baseball players. And I think there's butt cheeks in that.
So check it out.
It's not
everybody.
A musical. I think it's a play. I think it won the Pulitzer.
I think you're thinking of Damn Yankees.
No, Damn Yankees is a musical.
Where it's all new.
Take Me Out. Damn Yankees is actually a burlesque show about baseball players.
I think the, like, when they sort of dig in on all of those, what was Justin Kirk's character's name?
Pryor.
Yeah. The Pryor and the angel scenes.
Yeah.
When they talk about the various versions of that.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like, it's really, you can tell that was magic in the theater.
Yeah. Totally.
And that's really impressive and like hard to convey in a prose piece.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that was really well done, but that came down to who was doing the describing of being involved with that scene, whether it was the director or the actors or whatever.
Right. We kind of talked about last week a little bit about like, what is the thing? And we were talking about this in response to your writing, like you and your partner, you were writing a movie, I think maybe, and you had like an idea, but you didn't really know what the thing was.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's where this book suffers.
Yes.
Like that they have the idea and they have the right people and the right conversations, but that there wasn't necessarily a strong, like, why do we need this book?
Which is really interesting for a play that is so much about an idea.
Right.
Or a million ideas. But really, it's about this one thing for Tony Kushner. And I think it was actually reading this book that made me ask that of my partner.
Right. Like, what is our thing?
What are we doing?
Right.
If we're not writing about something.
That's true.
So, yeah, maybe that's what was missing, is there was sort of no guiding principle to
like, aside from like, it's the 25-year anniversary, or like, aside
that's
from
not
there,
enough.
Like, why why do this? And like, what are we driving at? I think that some of the stuff towards the end where they talk about how the show has become relevant again, not that it ever really wasn't relevant, but that it's taken on new relevance, like where we don't think, and this is not, this is probably more a comment on society, like that we don't think that the AIDS crisis is really a crisis. It's kind of like the AIDS thing now, but like that that's no longer what, where this book is super powerful. Now it's like all about the anti-migratory epistle and the global warming stuff, like all of a sudden is really relevant. And I was super interested in that conversation.
And to see a production that leans on that stuff would be fascinating.
But
to the same point, I thought that stuff at the end was great. And I also thought the first chapter where it gives you context,
so great,
which I was so unaware of because like I was a kid in the mid 80s.
Right.
And like, it's all the same as it was. Like, the way that the gay community was treated then was the way that immigrants are treated now. Right. And like, literally taking away services.
Right. Or trans people.
Yeah.
It's a different group, but it's the same bullshit.
That was really fascinating, in that the play came out as a response to that. Like, he was moved to action by that, to create art by that, I thought was really interesting. But I wanted to dig in on, okay, then what?
Yeah.
Because the part between the context and the play going up or doing those first reads was missing for me.
I think for me, because I really liked the book. I thought this was a really good book. I really enjoyed reading it. Obviously, I had a lot of the context of the theater part going in.
Yeah.
And I think that what I would have liked more of was the historical context as we move from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
Because they kind of had those timelines where they had that stuff. Like, it was kind of like on the top was like what's going on in the world, and on the bottom is like what's going on with the play and Tony Kushner.
I will say I suffered from reading it on Kindle because of that. Because I couldn't really see that
I
stuff.
I see. Yeah. Well, it was great. And I would have liked more engaging with those political moments. Yeah. Like, as you're doing the production in 2001 and 9/11 happens, like, what does that do to the show?
Yeah.
Or if you're, you know, when you did it in 1996 and what, you know.
So Every iteration. Because they were so different.
Because they must have leaned on whatever was going on in the world, as you do in the theater, just like Shakespeare, like every Shakespeare play, you know, in 2001 was basically a commentary on George Bush,
right?
And like, now everyone's doing Julius Caesar because of Trump. And like, what is that? Obviously, Angels is a little bit, the text is more accessible, slightly more accessible.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting to me too, and made me want to really read it, because there are passages from the play in the book, and it is written in this sort of elevated language.
Yeah.
That is, I don't know, that's really cool. I mean, it's more poetic than it is conversational, and I tend to like the really conversational.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made, like, it looks and feels like a musical. It's what made me think.
Yeah. Well, they said it was supposed to be, and then at the, like, that was in the beginning. It was like, it's supposed to be an audition. We had to audition and sing, and I was so bad. They were like, we're not going to make this
music,
a musical.
No music.
It's fine. We can do it with just words.
But yeah, I would have loved to see more about, like, what is the context of putting this on in this year? Because every version was so different.
There wasn't enough
about, like, there was so much about the technical aspects.
Mm-hmm. Like, how do you make an angel fly?
Yeah.
Which I also thought was interesting. Yeah.
But it was, like, I wanted to start a little earlier in the process for each version of it.
Right. Like, why did we decide to do this play?
Yeah.
Because I think that's often a question. Like, why would a theater produce a play at that time? Because it's a choice. It's a revival. It's not like, oh, we commissioned this new work, we need to put it up.
That's a good point.
So why did they want to do it? Obviously, it makes sense in 1991 why they would do it.
But 2016, when you put it up in London, it's a different story.
Totally. The thing that I found really interesting about the play that I think, I mean, I could probably talk about this for 6 years, is that this show was commissioned by the government because it was part of the National Endowment of the Arts, when in a time when we used to give money to the arts, our government used to do that. And to think that, like, this crazy, full frontal, gay sex, angels, Mormons, Roy Cohn, like all this, like, super in your face stuff. Like, nothing about this play is subtle, even a little bit. Like, Belize is a black, gay, drag queen, ex-drag queen, nurse who's administering HIV drugs. Like, there's so much in the play, like, when you actually break it down, to think that, like, the government used to do that.
Yeah.
Like the, yes, that the government used to do that. And like that, that's how we got this. This wasn't commissioned by some rich theater loving person in New York City. It was like Tony Kushner was like, I'd like to make this. And the National Endowment of the Arts was like, okay.
Yeah. And that
there was time to do it too.
There was so much
and
time,
space, and room to be like, yeah, this is a musical. Actually, it's not. Actually, it's two plays. Yeah. Actually, it's 8 hours of theater.
Which those back to back
sound amazing.
Performances sound incredible. Even like the version, I forget where it was that they talk about, where it was like basically a bare stage.
Mm-hmm.
And they were
In Amsterdam. That was the Ivana Ho version.
But that's an interesting point. And I think even further, like it's incredible that it went on to Broadway and before to become this huge success that like it was the Dear Evan Hansen, right? It was like people were coming from out of town to see this thing.
Of course.
Which was so bold and so in your face and so controversial.
Right.
Where now it feels like, well, here's the Tootsie musical.
Right.
Which now I'm going to see.
It's
but
lovely. I love a musical. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
But I think like even more than Dear Evan Hansen or Hamilton or anything like that, that this show, not only was it amazing and like people went to see it and came from all over, but that it talked about stuff that you're not supposed to talk about, especially at a nice evening on Broadway. Yeah. You know, like it's not Cats.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Like Hamilton is like hip hop Cats. Like Hamilton's good, but Hamilton is essentially a musical is a musical. It just happens to have a different cast than you're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And like the music is different. But as far as like structure and form, Hamilton is it's might as well be Wicked.
Yeah.
Like it basically follows the exact same plot as Wicked or the structure.
Wait, is that true?
Essentially, you know, you have like Not Throwing Away My Shot is like the.
I have to see Wicked.
Oh, you've not seen Wicked. Anyways, it basically breaks down
I don't
song
see
for song
musicals.
Wicked. Okay, well, that's why I'm here. But Angels in America like literally broke the form. Mm-hmm. And people say that a lot about things like, oh, this broke the form, which usually is code for like they put other people on stage who aren't normally on stage.
Right.
That's like usually what that means.
Yeah.
But Angels actually was different. Like
structurally, it made no sense.
Structurally, like it's a 3-act play and then a 5-act play, which is also crazy. And there's two intermissions per show,
mm-hmm.
as per Kushner's decision. All of that is to say that like there was a bravery in the way that the government felt art should be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of in the book, they talk about this, and I could have read like 6 chapters on Mapplethorpe and his photography exhibit on BDSM. Is that how you say it? I always get the letters switched around. Anyways, bondage and stuff.
Yeah.
And how basically the conservative right turned that sort of in-your-face artwork into a condemnation of queer people and people of color and said, we don't support this as a conservative bloc. So we do not think the government should support this. And so the government stopped funding art essentially across the board, but even more, it was even bigger hit on queer and people of color's artwork because it talked about the things that the conservative right felt were taboo. So like this play doesn't get made today.
Right. No, that was a turning point in the religious right taking over government.
Taking over the government and taking over the arts. As if the arts are a place for the religious right or left or religious anything. Like the arts are not a place for fundamental religion.
Well, listen.
You know?
It could be.
Sure.
If you are a religious person and you want to create art about
of
your
course.
Religion. Go for it.
Yes, of course. I'm saying like it's not a place.
Right.
They're not the arbitrator of art. My God. Unless you're making the Sistine Chapel. And like even still there's like naked bodies there or whatever. But so yeah, I don't know. That was really like intense for me to realize that I just assume all pieces of art are funded by the Nederlander Theater Group, right? Like because that's how it is now. Everything's Nederlander. And if you don't know who they are, they're like a big theater family. Anyways, they have all the money. Every Broadway show you love is Nederlander, basically. But this wasn't that. Like, this was like the government was like, here's a check. Good luck. And we don't care what you make. Just make something. Mm-hmm. We trust that it's going to be good. And we got this. And now I'm sure they would be checking in every day like, oh, can't have nudity. Ooh, too much gay. Like, you need a straight white guy. Like, you need this. You need
and
that.
And it is really, I mean, and you see this in this book, the way it affected people and the way it allowed people to be themselves publicly. Like, that's the best argument for government-funded art that I've seen, right? It's, again, it's about understanding humans as humans.
Right. We talked about this last week, and I think it bears repeating. We were talking about it in the context of, like, gay rights and trans rights, and that there's this idea that certain people shouldn't have the same rights as other people, and that's based on their lifestyle, right? Mm-hmm. So,
and this was an idea that you were behind.
Me? Yes, I'm very anti-human rights. Obviously, as a big reader, I hate humans. But it was like the argument has somehow gotten turned around where it's like, I don't believe in what you're doing, so I don't believe you should have the same rights as me. Instead of being, do you think that person over there is another human? Yes?
Right.
Great. We agree.
Check
they have
box.
All the rights. Like the
check yes or yes.
Yes. Like it's the question isn't, do I agree with everything you do, other person? And if I do, then you are considered a human and you should be able to use a bathroom.
It
or
seems
you should
simple,
be able
right?
to get married or you should be able to adopt children. Like, I don't need, no. The question is, do all humans deserve equal rights? Yes. Great. Is that a human? Oh, it is. Check. Yeah. We're done. And I feel like this book kind of drives that point home. And like the play too, like they talk about
going on the national tour and how families, people would come up to them and be like, my son's dying. Or I knew a drag queen once, or I knew Roy Cohn. And like that people felt seen in this show that was like really famous, right? Like it's like this great piece of art reflects something that I relate to.
But and because it was popular, because it was seen as a work of art, as a great work, then it allowed people to talk about it.
Right.
And I wonder, something that was not in the book that I'm really curious about that you may know about is like when you have a successful work like this, there are things that come after that sort of either try to emulate it or to various degrees of success. Did this change plays and popular theater for a decade after?
Content-wise or like...
Well, both. That's a, like some people do it with content and those are usually less successful. But some people sort of take the spirit of what that was, which is telling a big, honest story, right?
So I think a little bit. My understanding and from what I've seen and I know is like... I mean, I think there was a section towards the end, those gray sections where they were like kind of like deep dives on smaller things in the book. And there was one about like playwrights and like Lin-Manuel Miranda, the writer of Hamilton and Star. He talks about how like he, like people started doubling, like having one actor play two parts. And like,
was that not really done before?
Yes and no.
Not in like, such a pointed
not
way.
In such a, not in such a deliberate way to my understanding. Also like,
because I thought that was really fascinating.
It's so,
and it even works in the miniseries too. Like I'm glad they kept that.
The doubling is great. Mm-hmm. And like, so like in Hamilton, there's doubling.
And it's deliberate. Like
and it's deliberate. And it makes, it's a choice between these two people that this person has that person in them. I think also sweeping poetic kind of plays, they must have always existed, but that there's this idea that like you can be sweeping.
So what was that in the 90s and early 2000s?
I'm drawing blanks.
Take a break and look it up.
Let me think. Oh, I will say something else that the play kind of inspired, which I'm sure a lot of you would be familiar with, is Rent.
Oh, sure.
Rent came out in the aftermath of Angels, which is also, I'm sure, was inspired by the moment. It was 1996, like, you know, 15 years kind of after AIDS popped up and it became not so much a gay thing anymore, right? Because AIDS was like a gay thing.
Yeah. I think the book does a great job, again, putting that in context and like hitting home how much it was seen as a gay thing and how much people feared anyone gay.
Right.
And how much like the gay community was suffering.
Yeah. I don't think I will ever, hopefully I'll never understand fully what it was like in 1981 in San Francisco or New York or LA or whatever. But it's like, so after reading this book, I listened to Cleve Jones's memoir and he started the AIDS quilt and he was Harvey Milk's kind of like protege, helped him with his campaign. Yeah. He's in the movie Milk. He's played by,
I don't see movies.
Oh, anyways. Well, he's in the movie. If you've seen it,
who's he played by?
Emil Hirsch.
Oh, now I'll see it.
Okay. Yeah. What a babe. But you don't know who Emil Hirsch, he was in Into the Wild.
No, I don't see.
Okay, well, anyways, Cleve Jones has a memoir and it's all about his life. And it kind of starts in like the 70s, 60s, 70s. And he goes to San Francisco and he's like young and gay and like turning tricks and like this whole thing in the 70s. And then all of a sudden AIDS happens. And it's like every character essentially that he talked about is dead by the end of the book. Yeah. Like he talks about you make new groups of friends and they all die. And then you make another new set of friends. And Cleve Jones is HIV positive, but he's still alive. He got the right drugs, you know, at the right time. And it just, it worked out for him. But like his book and like this book and really the amount of devastation, like that so much art had to come from this, whatever it was. And then there's like the Normal Heart, I think came out right before.
Oh, that's right. And
like that was around. And then also Randy Schultz wrote the book and the band played on. Yeah. So there was like a lot of this like queer.
Which was a great oral history, by the way.
The band played on. Yeah. Is this an oral, it's an oral history?
It is.
I didn't know that.
And that's worth talking about, but go on.
Okay. I've still never read it. But yeah, so I do feel like, because the theater was hit really hard.
Yeah.
Specifically. like even more so than these cities that kids went to because they were gay and wanted to get out of. But yeah. then like going into the theater, like, so, I mean, there are people they talk about in the oral history that died. And I feel like there's so many voices that are missing from the oral mm-hmm. history just because of that. Like the man who built the wings, remember yeah. he had AIDS and he died.
And those stories, again, like they had the right, I don't know if they took the right portions or had the right people talking about them.
Like
they were so emotional. They were so heart-wrenching. This was not the last book I read that I cried, but I definitely cried.
Yeah, I felt things reading this for sure.
But you're also one step removed in reading this book because you're reading about people who are affected by a great work instead of being affected by the great work yourself.
Right. It's like you can't,
two steps removed.
Yeah, you can't have the play and like...
Yeah.
And the thing about even reading the play is like, I'm a firm believer that plays are written to be heard, obviously, because it's a play. If Tony Kushner wanted to write a book about AIDS and HIV, I'm sure he could do that. But he chose to write a play, like something that you see and experience. So I think it's even still hard. Mm-hmm. And I like to read plays, but it's hard because you have to kind of like imagine and comprehend and like, how does this sound?
It's a different experience.
It's a different experience. Yeah. So this, I think that's what makes the book hard is like, mm-hmm. it's those 2 degrees or 2.5 or whatever. Yeah. It's enough degrees.
That's interesting. I mean, that answers my question. Was Rent, and I'm not familiar with Rent. I've only ever seen a like sixth grade production of it.
Oh, amazing.
Which, obviously, very moving.
Rent is great.
Is it great? This is what I wonder.
It is. It's almost like infallible. It's like one of those plays. Have you ever heard of Spring Awakening?
Of course.
The play, the musical that came out recently. It's kind of like that. I call them museum pieces in the sense that you could plug anyone in who could sing it and the show works.
Oh, interesting.
Like, there are certain shows where it's like you need great actors. Mm. Like, I think Angels in America is probably one. Like, you need really strong actors. Exactly. Yeah. And I think sometimes in musical theater, you can get away with mediocre people. But Rent, Spring Awakening, Hamilton probably to an extent.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
You saw Bad People?
I saw a not great performance.
Interesting.
The play is still great.
Right. Like, that's kind of the thing. Like, you
shines
could have,
through, but...
Ugh. You can have people who aren't great, but like Rent... The music is so good in Rent. Like, there's so many bops. Like, you're just like, yeah, like, take me out tonight. Let's go. Like, woohoo. That it works. And the story is good. But the thing that's weird about Rent is that the writer, Jonathan Larson, he died, like, the night before the first preview. Or, like, the out-of-town. Not the out-of-town. Like, not even a preview. What is it called? They were doing it like off Broadway and he died before the first preview of that. So long before it ever went to Broadway. Wow. So my big thing about Rent is like most shows go through a lot of rewrites mm-hmm. and a lot of editing and songs get pulled. And I don't know how much of that they did because of the sentimental feelings of the writer having died. So Rent's great, but Rent's probably 30 minutes too long.
That's really, I will say I actually prefer that. And it's something I liked and made me want to see a production of Angels is like, it doesn't sound perfect. And that makes it perfect.
Right.
You know, like I want to see the seams a little bit in any great work of art.
Right.
And I think it has that. And they talk about it too.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know that this scene works, but it's in there and Tony wants it in there. So it's in there. And we make it work as best we can, but some actors are up to the job and some are not.
Some are not. Like,
I don't know. That stuff I found really fascinating.
Yeah, like how the thing gets made.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Rent is really good and it works and like basically anybody can be in it if you can sing it, like sing the right part.
Sure.
But it's not perfect because they didn't really rewrite it to my understanding very much.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's like a little more uplifting, but in the same way that that Angels that Pryor lives, Mimi lives and she has agents. She's supposed to die and she goes and she actually sees an angel and they tell her, go back and live. So like that feels very Angels in America now that I'm saying it. And I never thought that before. But
it's clearly influenced. I mean, how could it not be?
But I think that was important, right? Like that the play needed to reflect like some hope. Because it was written in such a dark time. Like he started writing it in like 86 or 88 or something.
I think even earlier,
Earlier. The first reading was 88 at the Eureka or something like that. So like that was before any drugs were working. That was like, if you got HIV, you were dead soon. And he wrote this play that basically said, well, maybe not.
Did someone in the book talk about that aspect of hope in it?
They did talk about it.
Was in there.
Yeah, hope was in it a lot. And that like it was important to Tony to have that. Cause it was like, I don't know, it was like a really bleak time. Like, I don't think we could reinforce that enough. Like,
yeah.
1980s, 90s in the theater in San Francisco. They produced it in San Francisco, LA, and New York. Like, I mean, in Cleve Jones's book, he talks about like the first 1,000 dead, and that it was like 2,000 people like a year were dying in San Francisco alone. Yeah. But also mostly right here in the Castro, you know, like
when they talk about people dying in the streets.
Yeah.
Like it's horrifying.
It's horrifying. One of the things that they talk about in the show and then kind of comes up later is Lewis, who leaves Pryor. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was like kind of a debate. I don't know if you remember, but there was a debate about if that was realistic, because mm-hmm. so much of, you know, the gay identity around HIV was that, you know, you couldn't come out to your family or you hadn't come out. So you kind of ran away to go live your life in another city. And then you get sick and you have no family because they're not there and they don't know about you. And the people who took care of you were other people who were also dying or close to dying. And that he made this choice in the play to have someone who turned his back on it. And if I think there was like a historian who said, this didn't happen. That did never happen.
That's insane.
And then Kushner's like, I know two people who did it. And right. they weren't as great as Lewis. They were like even he called them trashy. He's like, they were trashier than Lewis. But that like, because, and I think we have this now. I know I have this. Where it's like, you want to see the representation of othered people as good because you don't want the mainstream to talk shit and be like, right. gay people are leaving their lovers.
Right.
So like that there was this feeling of like Tony Kushner was doing bad by the gay community.
And I think this came from the book too, that I think something he did that was so smart was Lewis wasn't the only gay character. So he didn't have to represent every mm-hmm. gay character, mm-hmm. right? He wasn't carrying that right. weight. So he could be deeply flawed
right.
and make this decision right off the bat
right.
to leave his partner.
Right.
Because Pryor is another gay character.
Right.
And Joe is another gay character. Right. Like they could have these different shades and they can actually be people.
Right.
And if you have a character who just has to be like this perfect angel,
right,
for lack of another word,
there you go,
that's not good drama. Right. Like the play wouldn't work if you had that guy.
Right.
And
right.
I think Pryor is flawed and Joe is clearly flawed.
Yeah.
And,
you know, they all are.
Right. I mean, that's good drama. Drama is conflict. Thing.
Yeah. And they talk about, I think it's one of the Belizes says this, maybe mm-hmm. Freeman, I think. I like know everybody's last name, you know, because I'm like, oh, Freeman. He says that in any other play, Belize is like the token character because he's like the black gay guy drag right. queen, but that everyone in Angels is the token of another play.
Yeah.
Like that Roy Cohn is the token of, you know, the witch hunt play. What are they? Not the witch hunt. What was that? McCarthyism. Like, what's it called? Like the, you know, and that the gay Mormon is the token in Book of Mormon and like, so you know, funny. And so I think that that's part of it is it's like, these are all these weird kind of like fringy stereotypy people.
You're taking the side characters and making them,
the main characters,
giving them full lives.
Right.
Yeah. And that's like the great humanist triumph of the play.
Right.
It's what Kushner clearly does the best is bringing humanity. Even the angel.
Yeah.
Is so deeply flawed and confused.
And
like,
mean.
It's so neat. Yeah.
She's mean in the play.
She's
like,
a
I'm like, woo. Like, I don't, what if an angel came to your house and was like, fuck you, get out? Like,
and Emma Thompson is great in the movie.
She's great.
The angel. Like, that performance hit what they were talking about in the book home for me in a way that no conversation in the book about the angel
would
hit home.
The angel was the hardest character that they talked about in the book to understand. But what I did love how kind of after, I guess, starting in the second act of the book was broken down in five acts. The second act, every other chapter, they would do like a deep dive into the character and they'd have like basically everyone who ever played the character and any of like the major performances talk about it.
I really love that.
So cool.
Yeah. And I want that for every book about a play.
Yeah. I want to hear that because it was like a masterclass in acting from like the greats. And then it reminded me how many amazing people had their hand in this show at one point or another. Like Meryl Streep. Yeah. When they talked about
household
the Harpers,
names and not household names.
Yes. Like real really theater mean. People. When they talked about the Harper, it was like Deborah Messing.
Oh, that's right.
Mary Louise Parker. Marcia Gay Harden. Yeah. I was like, are you kidding me with
the
this?
The Marcia Gay Harden stuff was so interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know, for a lot of reasons.
I don't think of her as like a Harper in my mind.
No.
But she was her on Broadway, yeah. which I never knew.
And her way into the character.
The wig.
Yeah. Like there's so much weird actory stuff, mm-hmm. which is like, I don't always love reading about.
I usually hate reading about acting.
But this stuff was really interesting because, again, they're such complicated characters
right.
that you have to find a way into.
Right. Oh, and I forgot another yeah. Harper. Kazan, Elia Kazan's daughter, oh, yeah, yeah. whatever. Zoe Kazan or whatever. Yeah. yeah. yeah.
Like, which that's the performance I would love to see.
I would love that. Was at the Signature in 2010. Yeah. And I was in New York and I don't even remember them doing it, but Adam Driver was in that yeah. one. Also, that's the show that I'm like, that's the one.
I meant to look, but apparently there's, I think PBS did a thing
oh,
on
really?
That. So there's
some
probably not
of it.
The whole play, but there's, okay. there's stuff from it that I'm dying
yeah,
to see.
That's the one I'm like, I didn't know that Adam Driver was that good of an actor.
No.
But so he's going to be in Burn This on Broadway, which my college roommate is in, and it comes out in March. And I messaged my roommate and I was like, is Adam Driver really good? And he was like, he's phenomenal. I was like, did you know he was in Angels? And he was like, yeah, he's really a good actor. And I was like, okay.
Why don't you get him for the podcast?
But I have to go to New York and do it. I'm going to exactly. be like, Adam, I didn't know you were a good actor. Want to talk about it?
Turns out you're a good actor.
Turns out, tell me about how good you are. Because I just
Kylo
found
Ren.
That. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't think of him as being like a serious stage actor.
No, that's fair. I mean, I think that's true of a lot of these guys who
yeah.
pop up throughout.
That's
like
true.
Jeffrey Wright.
Well,
right?
he so was like a stage actor. See, I know him yeah. as Belize. Like, that's like one of the first things I knew that he ever did.
I know him as Basquiat.
I also know him from Hunger Games. He's in Hunger Games. He's
really?
Like the watch guy. He like does
remember.
Like the watches. He's great. He's also on like Westworld. He's,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he's like a serious theater actor. He's like a Shakespearean actor, like the whole
now
thing.
I know that.
Yeah, he's like the real deal. But there's just so like so many incredible people have been in this, which is like in and of itself an endorsement of the play.
I think so.
I don't think you get people to sign on.
That you get such
for 25 years.
Yeah.
Like maybe the first production, it's like got a lot of buzz, but like the fact that Nathan Lane's like, yes, I want to do this in 2017 yeah. in London. Like I want to go to London and do this play.
Yeah. And that they get such intelligent actors.
Yeah.
You know, they, like you said, like it's not just throwing someone into a part and letting the play do the work. It's,
right.
These actors really did the work.
Yeah.
And that's, that process was really interesting. You know, yeah. as much as the book wasn't enough for me about mm-hmm. Kushner's process, it was so much about the playmaking process.
Yeah.
And that was really neat. And I learned a lot from the book. Like I learned a lot about writing, even though there wasn't a lot about the process of writing. It
right.
was so much about what you mean when you write.
Right.
You
and
know?
Like what you're trying to do
yeah.
with the thing.
Being deliberate in your choices and taking risks and writing about something that's important and writing for actors. Like it taught me a lot about writing for actors.
Yeah.
For sure.
Like what kind of things did it teach you about writing for actors?
It just like at the most basic level, and it seems so obvious, but it's easy to forget, give them something to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give them different things to play in different scenes mm-hmm. and track that movement over the course of the play and let mm-hmm. them get somewhere and like give them a thing to play against someone else. And I don't know, like reading about the different actors' processes. And I love that the authors had such access to the actors.
Yeah.
Was really instructive.
Yeah. I liked hearing about people talking about the same thing over mm-hmm. and over in different ways.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting too.
And the discovery process too, like the early stuff in San Francisco and LA where the play wasn't really written as plays aren't. Like it wasn't written, but this right. seemed to go on for a long time.
It was like, oh, we started the show and then Tony finally brought us an act.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Let me ask you this as a writer, because they talk about how some of the parts were written for specific actors, mm-hmm. like from the beginning. Like the Angel was written for this woman, mm-hmm. Sigrid, who passed away of cancer, separate, but yeah. still devastating to this group, and that Steven Spinella was the inspiration mm-hmm. behind Pryor. And if you have written for an actor, how does that change when the actor changes? Or does it change?
When there's a different actor?
Yeah. So like you write a TV, I guess not TV is not the
It is frequently
thing.
Better.
Frequently better when the person is out and a
yeah.
different person goes in.
Because it means, and we had this a lot with the Thrilling Adventure Hour, mm-hmm. where we would write with someone in mind and then we weren't able to get that person, so we get someone else. And because you wrote with someone in mind, you have a very specific voice on the page. Mm. So when someone, and if like, you know, we wrote like for Dave Foley.
Okay.
And if Dave had done it, it would have been great, but it would have been exactly what we imagined. And we would have been so happy with that because every joke would have been delivered as perfectly right. as it was
exactly
in our
heads. Exactly what you wanted.
But when you get someone else in that role, especially if they're wildly different, everything is a little unexpected for you. Every delivery is a little unexpected and it makes it even better.
That's interesting.
Yeah. You know?
It's interesting because I think like, if you were going to see Angels in America, you'd want to see Steven Spinella as Pryor because he won 2 Tonys for it and it was written for him. But like you're saying, I wonder if that, even though you don't get that actor or the actor's mm-hmm. changed, if some of the way that it's written, like that person is still in it, you
for
know?
Sure. That becomes the character.
That becomes the
right?
character.
And then you get someone like Justin doing it, who
right.
I love Justin as an actor.
Yeah, he's
and
so
like,
great.
He throws away every line.
Yeah.
Even in those scenes where he's fighting with the angel and,
right.
and yelling at her or begging her.
Right.
It's so offhanded. Like,
yeah,
that's just
he's like
his
so
delivery.
Dismissive. It's like below, everything's below
yeah.
him, which
and
is like kind of great.
Partly Justin, but that's how he does stuff. And it's almost non-theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're getting this whole other level to the character, which is just his way into
right.
it, which I don't know. It's really, it's fascinating to me.
And that character Pryor, I feel like everyone who's ever done it has won an award. I think that,
is that right?
I think he won an Emmy for it. Steven Spinella won Tony's and mm-hmm. so did Andrew Garfield, who just did it the most
won
recent time. He won a Tony
oh,
for it also. Like, it's like
I
one
mean,
of those.
It's an amazing role.
I mean, it's a huge role.
I just found this note that I had taken where, like the magic of that role, and I forget who. Oh, it was Ellen McLaughlin who played mm-hmm. the angel in the workshops. Says Tony took an unapologetically gay character, severely ill with AIDS, and made him an everyman.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what an amazing role for an actor, but also an incredibly difficult role
yeah.
for an actor, right? Because
yeah.
you have to play this enormous idea of a person, but also this person.
Right. Right. And I think that also the thing that's, they talk about this a lot in relationship to Joe and Lewis mm-hmm. is that Pryor actually gets to be redeemed
mm-hmm.
and he gets a happy ending and he goes through a lot of shit, sometimes literally on stage, but he gets there and a lot of the other characters don't get that. And I love that too,
mm-hmm.
that like, that Kushner was saying something about people's choices, like good and bad or like good and evil, and how their life played out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just...
He had a world in his brain
yeah.
in writing this and,
yeah.
and an understanding of the mechanics of humanity, or at least his take on it,
right.
that he was able to put on a page. And again, that's the thing I wanted to hear more about.
Yeah.
You know,
like
how do
why
you...
Why this or how this?
Yeah, how do you dig into yourself and get that on the page? And clearly... It was a lot of work for him because it was always new pages, new pages, new pages.
Right.
But eventually he got there.
Right.
I'll mention one thing. There were contemporary reviews of the play in
mm-hmm.
the book, which I thought was fascinating.
I love those.
I really love that. People who didn't get it at all, people who thought it was, you know, the biggest thing, which it was. like, but just across the spectrum, different takes on this thing that they had to reckon with. I thought was really neat.
Yeah. I love reading reviews of things. Also just like going back and being
yeah.
like, what was the review of this like? One of the things that I think is important to talk about is like the role of gay culture in the show and like what it did to American culture or didn't do. One of the stories that I thought was really interesting is as a straight man who is straight white guy who was playing Pryor. And it was at ACT in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And he, like a friend of a friend, he got them tickets and they came. And during the gay, like sex scene or maybe the full frontal nude scene, I can't remember, they got up and they left.
Yeah.
And he like finishes the scene, goes off stage and he goes to the Belize, who's a gay black man. And is like, I get it. He's like, I don't really get it because
right.
I'm a straight white guy.
Yeah. And he does say that.
He does say, he's like, I get, he starts it with, I'm a straight white guy and I know that I'm not this. I know that I'm right. not that, but it was the first time in my life that I got it in that way, that like someone was so disgusted by my, that I disgusted someone. And I thought that that was really like a powerful thing, yeah, because that's what the play does, not just for the audience, but also for the actors. Like anyone who comes in contact with the show is like experiencing their own prejudices and their own icky things. Like I'm like, I hate to admit this, but I'm like, I'm probably a Lewis. I don't really like sickness. Like I'm not good. Like when people get sick, like I'm not the person who shows up. I'm like, can I Venmo you? Like, can I send you a Postmates? I'm not good with that.
Yeah.
But like reading the play being like, oh God, everyone would hate me. I have to just show up even though I hate sickness. It's so gross. But, and then they also talk about how, as a result, this is towards the end, as a result of the show, gay culture became more American, mm-hmm, but American culture did not become more gay. Mm-hmm. And I thought, fuck, that was a mistake.
Yeah.
American culture should have done better. We should have done better, right?
I think we can say that kind of across the board.
Yeah, but like to hear it,
yeah,
like this show was such a big deal. Everyone was seeing it. Like it was on tour, it was being produced all the time. And like that none of what we learned in the show brought gay culture. I hate to say assimilate because that's not what I mean. And assimilate is the wrong word. But that like it made more mainstream or like more comfortable for people to be around. You sit through 8 hours of theater and you still then see a gay person and you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know, like that's fucking sucks.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like you would think the impact of something like this, and I think it's there. Like, I don't think we have Drag Race without this play.
Sure. Of course.
I think because it was both bold and artistic and popular, you know, it's unavoidable, mm-hmm, that people have to look outside themselves and recognize that there are people not like them in,
mm-hmm,
the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we touched on this last week, but like, this is what art does. This is what great literature does, is at the very least, it makes you recognize that other people are people. But a watershed piece like that can only do so much.
Right.
And it was already, and we talked about this before, it was the closing in of the religious right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, coming into the years of conservatism and like, you can only, these changes are so incremental and
right,
it's so frustrating. And you want like a work to break the ground and open up this chasm that people fall in and everyone is equal.
Right.
And you can't, like, it, instead it's just a chipping away and chipping away and chipping away.
Ben Brantley says that towards the end of the book, he says, he's talking about Hamilton and something else. And he's like, people said like, this is groundbreaking and it changed a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I don't know how much these things actually change any games, which is like Ben Brantley, the theater critic at the New York Times. Like, what an asshole. But he's like so crabby.
And
they he's right.
Do. But I mean, he's right to an extent, because they do, like there's certainly a generation of people for whom Angels in America was just inconceivable 5 years before.
Truly.
And they could live in their bubble and not have to think about the world and the way that people who are not like them live.
Right.
And I think Hamilton does do that too. And I think, you know, there are a number of works that get to do that.
Yeah. I think that like the phrase game change implies that like everything changes. And I think that the correct answer is like, maybe it's like a rule change, you know, like in baseball, it's like you can only take this long on the mound.
Well, and it takes a long time to move a battleship.
Right.
Like that's what it comes down to. And I think we hear that a lot these days, mm-hmm, and that things are changing and so many people want things to change, but we're so entrenched in the old ways, like for 250 years at least, that it's just going to take so much time. And, and all of us are like, no, we're already there. We can do it.
Yeah.
We know we can do it.
I want to make
friends
this happen
like
now.
It.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have to wait for a generation to die out.
And not teach their kids anything.
Right.
Don't talk to your kids for the next 10 years. We need to help them. We need to help them see other people's humanity.
We need to show them a number of plays. We need to have them read a few books.
I would love to do a study abroad with your kid, please. For at least 10 years, they can live with me and I will help them learn about gay people and queer people and Black people and Asian people and just people, you know.
Well, we talked about this last week, but like there's such a lack of empathy in the world right now. And when you read about something like Angels in America, where people were forced to empathize or be seen as villains.
Right. He like bullies people into empathy, which is, I'm down for that.
Absolutely.
I'm like violence-free bullying towards empathy.
If you can create a thing that's so moving that it causes people's point of view to shift.
Right. Like that you see humanity in a different way. More of that.
Yeah.
More
I mean, can
that.
We like, look, on a basic level, the more stuff like that people are putting out there. Like I watched Eighth Grade this weekend.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard it's great.
Oh my God. Yeah. I watched a lot of horror movies last year. This was the scariest thing I watched.
Teenagers.
Yeah. Like, well, just being taken back to that time because if like, if you can be honest in your art and you can be real in what you create, then you're letting people experience that with you, with your characters. And it changes, it can change the way people think.
Well, okay. We have just two more little things to talk about. One of them is the title and one of them is the cover. My favorite things to talk about.
We talked about the title.
Yeah, you can't,
I can't remember it.
So the title is called The World Only Spins Forward.
Only Spins Forward.
And it's a line from the play. I think Pryor says it. But so you guys will have heard this already, but I talked to Isaac Butler and I asked him about the title and I said, you know, was this always the title? And he said, always, always, always. But I felt like another title could have been More Life. Because that's the thing that Pryor begs the angels for. He says, more life, more life, more life. And for whatever reason, I have been thinking about more life all the time. Like sometimes I get anxiety a little bit. And sometimes like when I don't want to do things, I've been like, more life. Like it's not, if it kills you, it kills you. But otherwise, more life. Like keep going. So I kind of felt like that. It's a little like.
I think that's a great title, first of all.
I like more life.
And
more
it's a great lesson.
It's a great lesson.
Yeah.
So in the notes of the play, in the acknowledgement section, Tony Kushner talks about more life and he says that he's deeply indebted to this person for which helped him like come across, and he translates the Hebrew word for blessing as more life. And that's what led. So like when Pryor is talking to the angels and begging them for more life, in another world, in Hebrew, he's saying like, bless me, essentially.
That's neat.
So I thought that was like kind of interesting
and
stuck with me.
It's a much better title.
Is it? I don't know. I like the title here because it feels like kind of like, because the play moves through time.
Sure.
I mean, the book moves through time.
It's a mouthful, though.
It's a mouthful, totally, 100%. What about the cover? I don't know if you've seen it in the hard copy.
I hadn't seen it because I read on Kindle.
Right.
I think it's really cool. I think like I'm so familiar with the poster
parting
for the play.
Yeah,
yeah, that angel artwork picture. That this is a neat take on it.
Yeah.
You know, like it is very much about the making of it. It's
right.
The nuts and bolts version of it.
This is the original picture. I think the taper or no, in San Francisco, the Eureka angel.
Oh,
those
wow.
are her wings. And Isaac told me that they went, it's at a museum in San Francisco and they like in an archive and they went and got it and they like staged this picture.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I think it's
there
beautiful.
Are there photos in the book?
Yeah, there's photos in the book.
I'll have to look at this one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't get any.
No photos.
Or I couldn't really see the
photos. See them, right. They're not great photos, a lot of them, but I did I think this cover is like, it was one of my favorite covers of books, I think, that I've seen in the last year or so. It's just really beautiful. And I like the pink.
I do too. I was
I
just
really
thinking
like
that.
The pink.
I think it stands out. It's also representative, obviously, but
it's not too heavy-handed. It's not like too. No. It's not like a pink triangle or something terrible.
No, it's a nice looking book.
Mm-hmm.
That might have actually the cover might have is why it might have been on my radar.
Yeah,
and then a couple of friends had read it and recommended it, but they're both theater people. So.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear from listeners what they think of the book as not if they're not theater people.
Mm-hmm.
I think a theater person will have feelings about it one way or the other, but I'm curious about people who pick it up who aren't like you aren't as familiar with the work at all.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly valuable.
Yeah,
and it's especially interesting as a book for how to put on theater.
Yeah, how to make
like
a show.
Very many ways into a play and how much you really have to think about that and what a director means and like all that stuff. I thought was absolutely fascinating. It wasn't about the part of the creative process that I'm particularly
interested in. Writing part of it. That's
so I have to get him for my podcast now.
Yeah.
Let's get Tony Kushner.
Yeah, I'll get
Tony Kushner. Sit him down for 2 hours.
He'll keep you there for 7.
I'll take it.
Yeah. I mean, anyways, do you have anything else you want to talk about before we get out of here?
I think we covered it.
I think we did too. Thank you so much, Ben. I'm linking to all of Ben's accounts and his podcast and all the amazing stuff that he's up to in the show notes. So make sure you go check that out and go read the Tony Kushner things if you haven't yet, and the Dan Coyce and the Isaac Butler, and read everything. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
And we'll see you guys in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening today. And thank you again to Ben Blacker for being our guest. Thank you to Bloomsbury and Sarah Mercurio as well. Remember to get your book recommendations read on the air. Email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to the show and awesome perks, go to patreon.com/thestacks. For one-time contributions, check out paypal.me/thestackspod. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.